It's 4:06, and you're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, we'll talk to a medical reporter about what she says the healthcare industry can learn from IKEA.
But first, we're going to reminisce about The Onion. Yesterday was the last print edition of The Onion in Madison. It's still available online, but no longer in newspaper form in Madison, the place where The Onion started. Madison was one of the last places you could get The Onion print edition.
And that's prompted a lot of reminiscing from people remembering the early days, reading The Onion. I found it in my first week in Madison back in 91, lying on the floor at the Union, or the ground at the Union Terrace, and discovering that. I've been in The Onion. I was a zombie. The zombie attack ruins Election Day voter turnout story, something like that. My
and
wife and I.
We'll be posting that picture online.
If we can find it, yeah.
And you get personal edification if you can spot Rob in the picture.
And I might have been in it again as guy totally looked like woman from behind. I'm not sure it was me, though.
Thanks for sharing that with
yeah,
us, Rob.
Yeah, well, there it was.
Well, here to reminisce with us is Stephen Thompson, writer and editor with NPR Music and founder and former editor of the AV Club and entertainment section of The Onion. Hey, Stephen.
Hello. How are you guys doing?
Good. Thanks for being back with us so soon.
Yeah, I hope you guys can hear me okay. I'm at a folk festival in Newport, Rhode Island right now.
Well, it's folk festival. At least it's not punk rock. So far, I can hear you just fine.
The band got louder right when I started talking.
All right. Well, I can hear you pretty good, but I'm sure you want to go party with the folkies. But so let's start talking about The Onion. So you are here at the ground floor of The Onion in Madison. What was it like, you know, in the early days?
Well, you know, it's funny. Rob mentioned, showing up on his first day and picking up The Onion in 1991. For me, it was 1990. And Pete Heise, who ran the business part of The Onion for many years, was actually delivering the paper. It was such a shoestring operation back then. And he hands me the paper. It says, the headline was UW sold to Waffle Restaurant. And he says, improve your mind, read an Onion. And it absolutely, completely changed the course of my entire life. I mean, having the physical paper there in Madison was a huge part of my student life, but then it ended up launching my career. I ended up joining The Onion 2 years later in the fall of 1992 and started running the fledgling entertainment section, which became the AV Club, and I ended up being there for 12 years, and I have no idea where my life would be without the paper there in Madison. So it's very sad that it's in physical form not going to be there anymore.
I bet there's a lot of people who would have loved to have been in on the ground floor of The Onion in Madison who just somehow missed that boat. But what was the culture like in the early days when you were putting the paper together, when kind of anything could go?
Well, I mean, you know, I think there's still a certain amount of anything goes that drives the Onion itself, and it's why The Onion has been good for 25 years. It's interesting when you say the culture. You know, a lot of great art comes from pods of people who manage to find each other by serendipity, and that's very much what happened at The Onion. When you look at the people who were there, even in the very early days, the people who founded The Onion went on to found The Stranger in Seattle, which is this enormously powerful and influential alt weekly. The two people who hired me, one is writing for The Simpsons now, and one is helping run The Colbert Report right now.
Ah.
And so, you know, it was part of it is, you know, and part of, for me, the joy of my career throughout my career has been to marinate in the genius of other people. And being at The Onion in those early days and for all 12 years that I was there was very much like that. I'm a big believer in surrounding yourself with the sort of people you'd like to emulate. And, at The Onion, very much creatively speaking, that's what I got to do.
Now, I heard a rumor that back in the day at The Onion, if you wanted a job there, one of the questions you had to answer was, what was the worst job you ever had? And also name a variety of meat slicer. Is this true?
Yes. John Crewson, who was there for many, many years and, you know, was the sports editor for many years, administered the Crewson test. Which included, the questions that you asked. And, you know, we would go around, and I remember, I was a stock boy in a grocery store. I had to, you know, when I was a kid, you know, I had to scrape congealed blood off the meat cooler floor with an ice chipper. And that was how you knew, that's how you knew I could work there. And I think that, you know, and obviously it was just in fun. It's not like we would actually eliminate someone from consideration if they hadn't worked a terrible job for minimum wage. But I do think it speaks to the Onion sensibility and what made The Onion stand out, as an incredibly powerful force in comedy. So many comedy writers went to Harvard, and it's not that people who went to Harvard have never worked at The Onion, but in those early days, it was a lot of UW-Madison students and UW-Madison dropouts, a lot of people from very small towns. I'm from Iola. John Crusoe was from Verona. And so, you know, we came from towns in Wisconsin and could speak to what it's like to be a regular person, a working class person, what it's like to struggle to make a living. And I think that kind of working class mentality has been crucial to The Onion's importance and to its success.
Do you have a favorite memory of working there when you look back?
You know, it's interesting. You know, I think everybody has a moment, usually in their 20s, where they cast that moment in amber, and it's where they envision their life having peaked. It's kind of a sad thing to think about, but I think it's true of a lot of people. And for me, if I were to pinpoint one place, it would be playing Team Onion softball. I got to be the coach and co-captain of Team Onion softball, and we were legendarily terrible. We were once outscored 72-0 in a span of 10 innings. There was a game where we were down 25-0 before we got up to bat, and those days of playing Onion softball and being terrible. I actually wrote a lengthy essay, which you can find online, about Team Onion softball and sort of what it was like to be a part of this incredibly silly thing that was also very warm-hearted and fun. And you know, when I think of like a perfect night, I think of playing Onion softball in Madison, Wisconsin in the late 90s and beginning of the aughts.
So that was the pinnacle, huh?
The pinnacle of my entire life.
A 72-0 softball game.
Yeah, I'm standing at the Newport Folk Festival surrounded by great music. My life is completely filled with blessings, and yet, you know, I have two amazing, perfect children. And yet, I mean, if you look at the 12 years that I was at The Onion, my favorite Onion memory, not my favorite memory of my entire life, favorite Onion memory was playing Onion softball back in those days. And I've heard that from a lot of my friends as people have, kind of toasted the end of the print edition of Madison.
So how do you feel about the end of the print edition? I don't know. I feel kind of sad in part because my 8-year-old has discovered it. And with some careful editing and censoring, I love reading The Onion with him. He picks it up at the newsstands and we go through it. He loves Kitten Thinks of Nothing But Murder All Day. He's one of his favorites.
Yeah, I love that.
But, I mean, do you think is something being lost when the print edition goes away, Stephen?
Yeah, no? I mean, I think that's happening all over in general. I mean, it's very much a sign of the times. It's not that The Onion is somehow now an unsuccessful brand. It's a product of print advertising has declined massively. To me, it's a real shame just because I'm a numbers guy and a milestones guy. The Onion is right on the cusp of the 25th anniversary of its first ever issue. The Onion published its first issue on August 29th, 1988 in Madison. And the fact that it couldn't make like 5 more weeks out of it to hit that 25-year benchmark is very sad. I love holding a paper in my hands, but then that's just the way it's going. Fortunately, there are still jokes out there, and you'll just have to point your child to your iPod or your iPad, I should say.
Well, Stephen, last question. What is your favorite all-time Onion headline from the Stephen Thompson tenure?
Well, it's not a headline of my own, but my favorite Onion headlines are ones, and you mentioned Kitten Thinks of Nothing But Murder All Day. I love the one-liners where there's no story with it, but you write the story in your head. And so I would say my favorite of all time is Man in Headlock Just Wanted to Party.
That is a good one.
You can write like 5 different stories about that in your head without any cues beyond the headline.
I love it. Well, we'll miss The Onion in print, but I'm glad that it lives on. Stephen, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you. It's my pleasure.
That was Stephen Thompson, writer and editor with NPR Music and founder and former editor of the AV Club, the entertainment section of The Onion.
Coming up next, we'll talk to a guest who says furniture maker IKEA can teach the healthcare industry a thing or two. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. You're listening to Central Time on Wisconsin Public Radio.
I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. You're listening to Central Time. Well, healthcare continues to be in the news today with an ongoing battle in Congress over provisions in the Affordable Health Care Act, widely known as Obamacare.
Our next guest is pursuing a different angle on improving healthcare in the United States. She says there's a lot of lessons to be learned from furniture maker IKEA. Pat Masters is a medical reporter and patient safety advocate. Her new book is Designed to Survive, 9 Ways an IKEA Approach Can Fix Healthcare and Save Lives. Pat, thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having me, Rob.
Well, I'm going to let that IKEA notion hang there in people's minds for a minute, and I want to first hear your personal story. You were a medical reporter, but you actually had a family experience that really set you thinking.
Yes, Rob. I had been a medical reporter, but then, an accident at home. My dad fell down the stairs getting up to use the bathroom one night and ended up needing surgery on his neck. And the surgery went great, but, as it happened, 2 days after his surgery, his intestines ruptured from what I later learned was an infection that's very common in hospitals. And even though I had been a medical reporter, this topic wasn't as well known then, including the particular infection he had. And as I researched this issue, since I had no idea why this had happened, I learned that 99,000 people a year die of infections they get in the hospital. And that was mind-boggling to me, that if I didn't know that, who else didn't know that? And what could we do proactively to be part of the solution to making sure this didn't happen?
And now here's the left turn. Why look to furniture maker IKEA to help solve this problem of hospital-borne illness?
Yeah, it's such a great question. And to be honest, I went to a bunch of conferences, healthcare conferences. I've been working with the Federal Partnership for Patients and a number of these organizations that are working really hard to improve healthcare in tandem with the system. And what I found is that it's all most of the talk is about what can we do to fix healthcare, very top down, which is a paternalistic approach that is historic in healthcare. And what was missing was the concept of partnership. And you'll hear this complaint from physicians oftentimes. My patients don't, I tell them what they need to do to get better, but they don't do what I say. And although I'm not one to say compliance is the answer, I think that that's the wrong word, what is necessary is for all of us to take some ownership of our healthcare outcome. And if we don't get the results we want, to be honest about why and to not make that somebody else's fault, because we have this prevailing attitude in this country, give me a pill, fix me, do some surgery on me, make me better, when we have so much more control over those things than we think we do.
And the IKEA model, you think, integrates, they make the customers part of the experience?
Yeah, I mean, with IKEA, and, I have no affiliation with IKEA. Mm-hmm. It's important for people to know that. But, as a mom with 3 kids that went to college, I, of course, love to buy the stuff there. And I won't say it's the easiest thing in the world to put together, but the IKEA model is that you get this flat-pack furniture. And their model is it's the same thing whether you're in Reykjavik or Roanoke. You get these flat-pack boxes. You get them cheap. You bring them home. You put them together yourself. And most of what they do is they have a very democratic process. It's not high end necessarily, but it's serviceable. It does the job. People are happy with it, as evidenced by their global success. And they don't mind kicking in some of the sweat equity to get a product at a reduced cost. And that model is largely missing from the healthcare equation today.
So just like the customer brings home that table or bookshelf or whatever and puts it together themselves, follow those instructions, you think there's a way that patients can comply, if we could use that word, can follow those instructions from the doctor. What is a good first step for hospitals, for healthcare providers to take to bring the patient on board and make them part of the experience?
Well, it's so interesting, Rob, because much of the solution is out there. There are papers that have been written, and there are mandates from the government to make language more simple and more approachable for the patient. For instance, the average healthcare literature, most healthcare literature, is written at a 10th or 11th grade level, and we're supposed to see all new materials being written at a 5th grade level, which is where health literacy is nationally, and in healthcare specifically, sometimes it's 3rd grade level. So we need pictures. We need simple you know, simple words that don't have the big, long scientific explanations. Because what happens when we don't have that is, for instance, you know, mother takes her baby home and doesn't understand the instructions and puts the medicine that he's supposed to take by mouth in his ear and punctures his eardrum. There are many, many examples of patients using instructions the wrong way. So simplifying instructions, and in the book, the chapter is, you know, if IKEA designed healthcare, instructions would be understandable to a fifth grader.
At first glance, that sounds a bit patronizing to me, but then I think I'm a fairly smart, educated guy, and I'm sometimes baffled by medical instructions that I read. And then I think, what if I am a senior in the early stages of dementia, or a non-native English speaker, or something about my illness is making it harder for me to focus on what I'm doing? That's the kind of people we're talking about reaching out to, right, by simplifying these instructions.
Oh, exactly. And, you know, I just went through this myself. My daughter was in the hospital for a paralyzing nerve disorder, and it was terrifying. And I like to think of myself as an educated, empowered, and knowledgeable healthcare consumer. But when you're in the throes of this event, you need everything almost. You need somebody looking you in the eye. You need them saying, "Are you listening to me? Tell me back what you heard." And obviously, you need somebody else with you, if at all possible. So I don't mean any of this to sound patronizing, but the reality is, when you need health care, when you're in a crisis, and that's why we go to our doctors, because people want their health care on a need-to-know basis, it is essential that you leave there knowing what you need to do. It's like you don't leave a, you know, a fifth grader doesn't leave a classroom without instructions about how to do his homework and how to succeed, so that, you know, he asks the questions of the teacher before he leaves the room. And, you know, we're just in a constant state of learning, and healthcare has become so incredibly complicated. There's so many treatment options. We need to find the simplicities and extract them from this process so that we can be participants and have better outcomes.
A lot of what you write is from the healthcare industry side, but you also have a message for us when we go in. And you've mentioned, you know, bring somebody with you. I think bring a scribe is how you put it. But how do we need to change our mindset when we go into the doctor, from what we're doing now that maybe isn't working so well to how we should be as patients?
Oh, wow. That's such a great question. I think, you know, it's like so many things in life, Rob. It's like insurance or all those worst-case scenario things. I mean, I have an incredibly healthy family, and my daughter is 26 years old, and she hiked the entire Appalachian Trail last summer. And here she was, unable to walk, and within the space of 4 or 5 days, she was facing a paralyzing nerve disorder and was in the midst of it. The mindset we have to have is that that knock on the door is going to come for us somehow in some way. We don't know what it's going to be, and nothing can stop it from happening. And do you really want to be, you know, caught unawares and blindsided by this medical crisis? Or do you want to have a basic understanding? You know, it's almost like that emergency kit in the, you know, under your sink or in your bathroom, the fire extinguisher that you have on hand. You need to have a basic understanding. What am I going to do if this happened to me tomorrow? How can I ensure I'm going to be there for my mother, my father, my child, my friend?
But there's you mentioned a paternalistic approach to this, a top-down. And as a patient, you know, having been to the doctor or whatever, I kind of get it. I want to go in and say, hey, you guys are the experts. Take care of me. Fix the problem.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and the reality is that, about 8 or 9 years ago, a very prominent physician just threw out a quote there. He said, if I read 2 journals a night, at the end of a year, I'd be 400 years behind. There are so many publications, so much new information coming out. It's like a fire hydrant of information that our doctors, our care providers, as good and committed and wonderful as they are, and they go into healthcare to do that, they cannot keep up. Now, when you are afflicted by something and have a condition, you have the capacity between you and your tribe around you, your family and friends, to become an expert. And I'm not suggesting that you go to your doctor with a printout, like, you know, from Edmunds.com when you go to buy a used car, that you say, look what I found. You have to distill that, you know, do some thoughtful analysis of what you find. And then you're going to find some disconnects with what your physician has said. And it's, when I say disconnects, I don't mean, you know, that you're going to argue with him. I mean, there are things that you're going to ask about. And I found this myself recently, as I said. And so the point is, you want to be a partner. If you approach your physician respectfully as a co-producer of this outcome, the way that, you know, IKEA has created these co-produced outcomes, you're going to have a better outcome. You're going to have a more successful end result.
Pat, and I'm going to jump in there, and we'll pick up on that theme and what healthcare providers can do to encourage that. We're talking to Pat Masters about her new book, Designed to Survive, 9 Ways an IKEA Approach Can Fix Healthcare and Save Lives.
And we want to know what you think could be done to help administer and fix healthcare. You can reach us at 1-800-642-1234. That's 1-800-642-1234, or send an email to talk@WPR.org. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.
I'm Veronica Rickert, and you're listening to Central Time on Wisconsin Public Radio.
I'm Rob Ferret. We'll pick up our conversation now with Pat Masters, talking about her new book, Designed to Survive, 9 Ways an IKEA Approach Can Fix Healthcare and Save Lives.
And we want to know what you think about your experiences with healthcare as a patient or a provider. What do you find works, and what really needs to be fixed? What do you think of our guest solutions? You can call us or email at 1-800-642-1234. That's 1-800-642-1234, or send an email to talk@WPR.org.
We'll get to your calls in just a moment. But first, Pat, before the break, we were talking about how patients should be empowering themselves to take charge, be part of the team in handling their health care. What can hospitals, healthcare facilities do to just make it easier and to welcome that sort of input?
Well, welcome is a key word, Rob. And in fact, the first chapter of the book is, if IKEA designed healthcare, we would always feel welcome. I mean, how many times have you gone into, whether it's a lab or a clinic or even a hospital waiting room, and, you know, the magazines are ancient, they're peeling signs on the walls, the scotch tape is browned, it's dusty, the plants have died. Irma Bombeck said never go into a hospital where the plants have died. So it first of all, it's making you feel welcome. And that's not about fancy granite lobbies and, you know, fountains and spending a lot of money on the lobby. It's about making sure that, first and foremost, that the staff see you and listen to you. And you know, it's interesting, when patients do their patient satisfaction scores, which are a big, big driver of quality improvement, it's telling the hospitals what to spend money on. So if you say, oh, the food was great and the parking, you know, the lobby was beautiful, you're telling them that's what matters to you. But most people, when they have a bad experience, it has to do with poor care. It has to do with somebody not listening to them or the ball being dropped and there being a bad outcome as a result. So just be aware, first and foremost, for the hospital and the patient. We need to understand each other in terms of making sure the patient appreciates the care. The patient should give feedback about the care, and hospitals can reach out to patients and ask them to give feedback about what really matters to them. And that will drive some of the cost economies and sense and simplicity back into how we deliver health care.
We'll go to our callers now. We have Diane with us in Green Bay. Diane, hi, you're on the air.
Hi, this is a wonderful topic and very near and dear to my heart. My husband has a very rare form of cancer, and I live here in Green Bay. And we had gone to the provider's office, and when we first were diagnosed with this very rare form of cancer. And the approach that I took was I did my homework myself in advance of all the office visits. And I didn't go in acting like a smarty pants. As a matter of fact, I acted as though I knew nothing. And so I asked a bunch of questions, and as I asked each provider their opinion about this or that and this treatment or that treatment as they brought it up, I found that they weren't as knowledgeable about it, and some of them actually didn't even do their own homework. Because when I would ask them if it was one type of the cancer or the other type, they were stumped, like, huh, what are you talking about? So what I found was, in order to get the best outcome of your own longevity and survival, you really had to do your own homework and then approach it as a partnership, but very informed.
Thank you so much for the call, Diane. Pat, sounds like she's speaking your language.
Yeah, Diane, first of all, congratulations to you for doing this, at the outset. That is, you can't imagine how often that's a determinant of what happens ultimately. And you're so right. Being respectful it's the key to not just our medical relationships, but every relationship. You don't want to be the smarty pants. You don't want to be the one that sets people on edge. In fact, if you're a little too aggressive, people will, it's admitted by providers, they'll avoid your room. So you have to be collaborative and respectful, but you're right. It is impossible for them to know everything. Even in a specialty like oncology, if you just Googled, the literature that comes out in a given month, it's just incredible. So the more you know, the more you're going to be able to filter appropriately what your providers tell you. So I hope all's going well with you, Diane.
Yeah, Diane, thank you for calling, and good luck to you and your husband. We'll go now to Paula in La Crosse. Hi, Paula.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I just wanted to comment. I've been in healthcare for 30 years. I'm a registered dietitian, and I guess maybe bragging a little bit about my profession, but we've really been trained in really talking with patients on their level, and there's something, a buzzword out there, and I'm hoping more and more providers are trained in this, but it helps you really get that empathy. It's called motivational interviewing. And I've worked with patients with chronic diseases, and these changes we ask them to make can be really hard. And that motivational interviewing, we can find out so much more, and patients will comply a little better if we're able to talk to them more in a conversational, motivational style.
So this isn't just, you need to stop eating this, do this exercise, blah, 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 okay, bye. But it's
exactly
different than that?
Very much so different. It's finding out about what's their lifestyle like, what's their family life like, maybe why aren't they, as you follow them, especially maybe speaking more physician standpoint, why aren't they following this? And, physicians I've worked with, they get so frustrated. Why aren't they doing this? Why aren't they doing this? Well, it sometimes is, and your guest is right, that they don't understand the instructions. So we have to make sure those are done in a simple way, but it's also the way those instructions are given. It's that motivational interviewing, and then to have a team around you that you can refer them to, whether it's a dietitian. Maybe they need to see a social worker because they can't afford their medications, or they're illiterate and they don't want to tell you these things, or a psychologist to work with people's behavioral problems.
Paula, thank you so much for your call. This all sounds well and good, Pat, but it sounds expensive.
Well, we are shifting a lot of the money we're investing in healthcare, especially as Obamacare comes down the pike, to go into what they call the patient-centered medical home. And Diane is right. If we don't understand what motivates the patient, we're just spending money on nothing. There's one patient, her only goal was to be able to mow her lawn again. That was her joy every week, was to mow her lawn. She didn't care about having a whole range of other activities that the clinicians thought she should want. So what we need to do is, it's proved, by the way, that if we have what Diane calls motivational interviewing, if we identify the goals and the patient contributes the work, it is less expensive. There is less testing. There's less medication. There are less office visits. So truly applying the concepts of streamlining efficiencies and economies and getting patients to cooperate, whatever that takes, is a very sound and cost-effective way to approach healthcare.
Well, what you just said there, in that instance, not only was the patient being a partner in treatment, the patient was defining the goal of what a successful outcome was.
Exactly. And so they're not going to overtax the system. They're not going to be unhappy and be on a whole bunch of medications that sometimes are in conflict with each other. And ultimately, what I love about what Diane even brought up is that we're looking at the whole person, not at a collection of symptoms, which which is another archaic paternalistic model of healthcare. I am not just a fever of, you know, 102 and a high blood pressure. I'm a person that comes to you with motivations and hopes and stubbornness. So the more you can find efficient ways to drill down to what that is, in your practice, the more we're going to have the patients responding well, and the more partnership happens, and the better outcomes we'll have.
Are you seeing hospitals, healthcare providers pick up the ideas you're talking about and trying to put them into place?
There is so much money, effort, and time being expended right now. I'm working with the Partnership for Patients, which is it's an organization out of Health and Human Services, to bring the patient voice in and to really try to bring that side of the partnership into the healthcare equation. So the answer is yes, there is a lot of work going on there. But oftentimes at these conferences, there may be very few patients because patients are, they're not funded by their hospital or their organization to attend. So it's difficult to get some degree of parity in the weight and the volume of the patient voice in these events. So the things I am talking about are really not argued about in the healthcare world. What I'm trying to do is to point to an analogy that makes sense to both the people delivering healthcare and the people receiving it. Because it's only when we understand each other's constraints and realities that we can come together and solve it together.
Pat, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you so much. I appreciate it, Robin, Veronica.
That was Pat Masters, medical reporter, patient safety advocate. Her new book is Design to Survive, 9 Ways an IKEA Approach Can Fix Healthcare and Save Lives.
And coming up, our news guy Noah Ovshinsky will be by to talk about the top stories of the week here in Wisconsin. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.
I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network.
And now we check out the top stories of the week here in Wisconsin with Noah Ovshinsky, WPR's Assistant News Director. Hey, Noah.
Good afternoon, Veronica.
How you doing?
I'm good. It's Friday.
I know. Can't argue
with
that.
Life is good.
Well, maybe life not so good. Some trouble in the state capitol for some folks there on both sides. So tell us what's been going on.
Yeah, one of the bigger news items this week we've really had the most arrests we've seen in some time in the state capitol for those folks who are protesting. And starting on Wednesday, we had 22 people were arrested by Capitol Police. This was during the noontime sing-along that has happened for quite a while there on the state capitol. More people were arrested yesterday, and from what I understand, more people were arrested today as well.
So what occasioned these arrests? This has been going on for a while. What changed?
Right. Well, what changed was a recent court ruling several weeks ago. A federal judge put down a ruling basically saying that the state wanted initially to require any protester, if you're going to be in a group, to have a permit in order to protest at the Capitol. And what this judge said was, if you're a group smaller than 20 people or fewer, you don't need a permit. You can just gather, you can sing, you can protest, you can do essentially whatever you want. But if you have groups larger than that, you need to get a permit, which is required by the Department of Administration. And what happened after several warnings by police, groups that were larger than that magic number, which is 20 people, the police then arrested those folks for violating that rule.
So the protesters didn't get these permits. Do you think that's what'll change? Are people going to trot off and get the permits and come back?
Well, the DOA has said repeatedly, as well as the Capitol Police, that they're free to apply for those permits. Will they get the permits? We don't know. But what we do know so far is that they haven't applied for those permits, and they will they keep on continuing to show up and protesting, and they keep on getting arrested. And one of the interesting things, Veronica, I think it bears pointing out, is these noontime sing-alongs over the course of the last year, I don't want to say they're like petering out, but they were becoming far less popular over time. And what these recent protests and this recent crackdown over this permit issue, what it has done is it has really brought people together. And we've seen numbers of protesters that we haven't seen in a while.
So opposite response there. People are coming together and the Capitol is getting busier again for these sing-alongs.
Yes, like. It is. Unintended consequence, perhaps. It'll be very interesting to see how this plays out.
So a protester shows up and they don't have a permit. They get arrested. What happens?
If you're convicted, of course, you will be fined $200 and 50 cents.
And 50 cents.
Yes.
Okay. Well, we'll be watching that one. See how the protesters respond.
Yeah. I don't think the story is over.
All right. Well, another area we've been watching is the tension with mining, especially up in the northern part of the state. Give us the latest there.
Yeah, always a very controversial issue here in the state. This is one of the latest, actually, I consider to be one of the latest developments in the mining debate. A group of legislators announced this week that they plan to introduce a bill that would prevent people from getting within 50 feet from these drilling sites and 300 feet from what's called bulk sampling, which is a much more invasive way of sampling this ground for potential, you know, mining purposes. And it's very interesting. It's sponsored by Democratic State Senator Bob Jauch, along with Senators Dale Schultz and Tim Cullen. So again, another attempt, by the legislature, at least, or by some legislators, to bring some order to what, you know, so far has been a somewhat chaotic situation.
Right. There's been a lot of tension up there. We've heard some of the audio on this program about just how tense it's been getting on the mining side and on the protesters side up there. Is this just a legislative effort to just put some more distance, to put this on ice a little bit?
Yeah, I mean, I think it depends on where you stand on the debate. And based on that, you'll look at this as either a positive or a negative. I think the question moving forward, if legislators move forward on this, and of course, it hasn't been introduced yet. But if it does, the question will be, is how far is too far and how close is too close? You know, you want to obviously protect the rights of the mining company to mine there, as the state says that they have the right to do, versus the public access right, because this is on public land, the public access right to hunters, whoever else wants to use that land. And so it's a delicate balance. And I think in the coming months, we'll see, you know, where that balance tips.
Any reaction from the protesters up there to this yet?
Not yet. Not that I've heard. Again, this legislation is in the very early stages, but we'll see where it goes.
All right. And yet another thing we're keeping an eye on, there has been a hearing on night deer hunting that's been getting some traction lately. What's going on with that?
Basically, there was a hearing this week. It just wrapped up actually a few hours ago. It was a hearing in a lawsuit that will determine whether or not the tribes will have the right to hunt deer at night in the ceded territory, which right now is not allowed.
So how long has this been the case and why now? Why are they trying to push it now?
Yeah, well, the state in the early 1990s, there was a court case where basically it said you could not hunt deer at night in the ceded territories. And the tribes sort of let it lay for a while. While night hunting was a common practice back then, they sort of let the issue lay. Now, since then, the relationship between many of the tribes and the DNR and the state government has really deteriorated over concerns like mining, over the concerns using elk for spiritual practices and religious practices, things like that. The relationship is very bad right now. And, you know, if you were to ask me, I think this is probably an effort by the tribes, you know, probably not only to do something that you know, members have done in the past, but also to exercise what they see as their rights in these ceded territories. And one of those rights they see is the ability to hunt deer at night. So it is about deer, but it's also about their ability to exercise the rights that they have.
Now, what about wolf hunting? Didn't the state approve a wolf hunting season that included night hunting?
Right. I think that was probably one of the things that really sparked this debate again, because the tribes were really unhappy, A, that there was a wolf hunt instituted. And certainly initially the legislature passed, basically when they passed the wolf hunting law, that night hunting was allowed. And the tribes were really against that because, A, they don't approve of night wolf hunting, and they don't approve of wolf hunting in general, because wolves have a spiritual, you know, they're very, like, very much valued spiritually by many of the tribes up north. And so I think that was probably one of the things that really sparked this new debate over night deer hunting.
So how close is this one to being resolved?
Well, as I said, testimony wrapped up today. And I think, you know, we'll probably get something, you know, some sort of, you know, I would think a decision certainly by November, which I believe is when the season begins or is expected to begin.
And I don't know, are you expecting to see the relationship evolve based on the outcome of this, as you're talking about between the DNR and the tribes up north?
Yeah, I don't see the relationship getting better, to be honest, anytime soon. The mining issue remains divisive. The creation of the wolf hunting season remains very divisive. And, you know, this debate over night deer hunting is just one symptom of that.
So this will not be the closing chapter in that.
No, not by any means.
Okay, you've got one last story for us to talk about, and this is one that didn't get a whole lot of coverage, a Supreme Court ruling on power lines.
Yeah, this one kind of flew a bit under the radar. And basically what this decision by the Supreme Court had is basically basically what they decided was, so a power company comes along and they buy an easement from a private property owner in order to put up a power line. And traditionally what happened is those power companies or utilities paid that landowner or homeowner for the easement. But they never really took into account what effect that power line was going to have on the property values as a whole. And so this family sued American Transmission Company, which is a company that owns power lines here in the state, basically saying, you know what, not only, you know, did you, you know, you paid us for the easement, but that's not enough because now we've got a power line in our backyard and our property values have gone down and you owe us that money. And so what this means, especially now at a time when the state is buying and building more and more power lines, is how much money are these landowners and homeowners going to get when these utilities come in and want to put in a power line or whatever, you know, it could be a gas line, water line, whatever. But how much money are these companies going to pay these families for the right to put this stuff on their property?
Now, we're talking one of the big above ground giant power lines. We're not talking about something underground.
No,
that wouldn't affect property value. Did the homeowners okay the easement?
They okayed the easement. They did. But
they got more than they were expecting.
But they got more than they expected. And what they expected, or what I should say, what they didn't expect, was a decline in property values.
All right. So we'll be watching that one and see how that one evolves.
Yeah. And I would say, you know, even if you don't have a power line being built in your backyard, this may have relevant to your life because at least according to the transmission companies, they say that this will likely lead to higher electricity bills for everybody because they're going to have to pay landowners and homeowners more in order to build these lines.
I see. So the pressure's on both ends there.
Indeed.
Property owners and our electric bills.
Yep.
Well, you know, maybe we've got to talk about one more story here. I don't think it's news to anyone at this point, but Ryan Braun's, I guess you could call it a fall from grace. Is that too dramatic?
No, I think it's a fall from grace.
Yeah, he was in a state of grace. He was the Brewers' big star on the team and suspended.
Yeah, he's been suspended for the rest of the season by Major League Baseball. You know, there was a lot of rumor. There was a lot of anticipation. Was it going to happen before the All-Star game? Was it going to happen after the All-Star game? When it was going to happen? When is it going to happen? Is it going to happen? And we now know that Major League Baseball is indeed going to suspend and has suspended Ryan Braun for the rest of the year.
And even Packers quarterback Aaron Rodgers chiming in on this one, saying he feels his feelings are hurt as well. This has got a lot of reverberations for the state of Wisconsin.
You know, absolutely, because this is something that he denied. And obviously the truth has come out, and it's certainly not good for him. It's not good for the fans, and it's not good for the Brewers organization.
Ticket sales going to go down, you think?
It's hard to tell at this point because there's been a lot of injuries, and ticket sales are down anyway because of those injuries, because the team isn't doing that well. So I think it'll be hard to tell, you know, what effect the suspension will have ultimately on ticket sales because there are a few other factors going on.
All right. Well, Noah, thanks for stopping by, and we'll chat with you again next Friday.
Sounds good. Thanks, Veronica.
All right. That was Noah Ovshinsky, WPR's assistant news director.
Coming up, we're going to talk about people who like to make stuff, the rise of the maker movement with Mark Frauenfelder. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. You're listening to Central Time right here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Stay with us.